Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Make no mistake, Trump-backed Bernie Moreno was a MAGA mistake for black families in Ohio.
We're not going to replace racism in this country from decades ago with a new form of racism, which is what DEI is.
If Bernie Moreno is elected senator, he will support the MAGA playbook and implement the thinly disguised Racist Project 2025 agenda. That means ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs that exist to correct the impacts of racism. MAGA extremists like Moreno believe programs that have helped our families are entitlement programs, but they have no problem giving their buddies a boost by passing more tax giveaways for rich folks like themselves. Black Americans like me have worked hard and persevered in fighting for a fair shot. We've come too far to let self-serving extremists like Bernie Moreno take us back. That's why we must re-elect Senator Sherrod Brown. He has fought for equal opportunity for black families and will continue to do so. Go to OhioVoterGuide.org and register by October 7th. Paid for by Win Senate, which is responsible for the content of this ad. WinSenate.org, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
I'm ready.
Introduce yourself and
the song. Okay, we're going to do a song first, and then I'm going to subject you to my words that are not in melody form. Take a ride at the red light, baby. And you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. I got two loving arms, I can save you if you make it to me in the middle of the night. So snap your fingers and tap your toes and keep your eyes peeled, baby, for them hoes in the road. And turn it up, sweet rock and roll. Put your right foot down and let the clutch go. Take a ride at the red light, baby. And you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. I've got two loving arms, I can save you if you make it to me in the middle of the night. Well, now early in the morning when the street lamp's gone and your head's hanging down and your engine light's on, well, I know it's late, but you ain't gotta go home. Come on, come on, baby, I can help you be strong. If you took a ride at the red light, baby, and you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. I got two loving arms, I can save you if you make it to me in the middle of the night. Well, I don't claim to be better, but I can wipe the mud from your hard-pressed feet. You might be thinking that you'd never, but if you're fresh in the fight, well, that's all right with me. So take a ride at the red light, baby, and you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. I got two loving arms I can save if you make it to me in the middle of the night. And sometimes them lights, they might blind you when you're holding on tight with it spinning in your hand. If you don't move fast, they might find you. Don't miss your chance, you better run while you can. Take a ride at the red light, baby, and you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. I got two loving arms I can save you if you make it to me in the middle of the night. You can take a ride. Take a ride in the red light, baby, and you know it don't matter if you don't think twice. You can take a ride. I'll introduce myself now. Are we still rolling? Did you stop?
Yeah,
oh, good. Yeah, that's fine. Good.
Thanks,
good.
We're rolling.
Are we still rolling?
Yeah, we're rolling.
Oh, shucks. Okay.
Just get everything set.
All right, we're still getting set up, and you just had a behind-the-scenes moment if that stays in there, and I suspect it will. But that's all right. It's all right. You know, Jimbo told me one time when I was recording with him in Como, Mississippi, and we actually recorded that song, and he played bongo drums on that one. And this one album that me and David had called Raised in a Barn, it's never been heard. But Jimbo was telling me one time, and you know, I have great respect for Jimbo Mathis, that the, and I don't want to call them mistakes, but the asides are important in your work.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular song, I wanted to go back and do like an overdub on some of the parts and come in and say, you can take a right, you know, like after the chorus. And I, he said many, many poignant things, and who knows, maybe in this interview I'll say some, but, I said, and he's like, I don't know about doing that. You know, we got it. I said, I don't know. I mean, I kind of like the idea of it. You know, I said, well, let's do it then. So he do what you want. Let's do it. But who you going to be? And I went back and I did, you can take a ride, you know, here and there. And it, and then we got done. We listened to it and I said, so, you know, tell me, I was really like, well, you, is it better?
Right.
You know, I was wanting some confirmation. I was wanting some affirmation that I had made the right decision. This is it better. He says, maybe 25%, maybe not, whatever that means. But I get it now, Jimbo, after these years. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, that particular aside wasn't an aside at all. It was a reallocation of something. I don't know. I ask him a lot of questions. I got so much out of that recording session with Jimbo that was not musical because, you know, we locked those doors in Como at Delta Recording Service and went for it for 48 hours and had many conversations, and he was candid and he told me the truth. And I appreciate that about people, especially someone with that great experience and had a time to you can unplug that fridge if you want to. It's a black one on the bottom. It'll be cold. There we go. I saw Jimbo about, a month ago or something. He played in Jackson. He was in there.
I recently called him, and he came on the show. We had a brief interview when he came to the Columbus Art Council, and there's a lot of wisdom in Jimbo Mathis.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there is.
But, I mean, back to what you were saying back in Jackson.
I love that show. And I got there for the last half of his final set, whole set, I don't know, because I was... had things going on, and I rolled in there, you know. And what a band. Oh, what a sound. It was,
mm-hmm.
And if you know, I've heard Jimbo many times, you know, here and there, especially long before I knew Jimbo at all, you know, back when I lived in Oxford and in North Mississippi, I could ease around there and check him out. And let me tell you, like, the new show, that to me was the new show, was it was sort of...
With the Dialback Band?
The new band,
mm-hmm.
You're gonna have to forgive me.
I think it's Matt Patton and all those guys from Dialback.
Well, the new, it's not new, but like the sound I heard the other night was uncommonly new to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like the delivery, everything with the. He was.
I mean, that's who it was.
It was inventive. He had an inventive delivery, and like I was shocked. In some ways, at some of the work he had done, not in a bad way. I was like, this is the meter of these words is unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming out in an unconventional way. Like, I'm not going to say rap or anything, but there were moments in there of refined asides that were spectacular. Spectacularly shocking if you've never heard them, the way he was laying out those lyrics. It was like he was giving a class to me yet again, even from the stage. And he didn't know I was in the building at that time.
Uh-huh.
I was taking a class at that show from Jimbo on how to surprise your audience
with something new and old. And we got around to the end of the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, we got one more song, you know. I'm like, what's it going to be? And he breaks out with Carmelita. You know, Carmelita, uh-huh. Hold me tighter, I think I'm sinking.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't even his, you know, but it didn't matter because it was on point. And, of course, I was wondering, I was like, will that in fact be the last song? Like, will he even come back? Of course he came back. Of course he came back. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the other vocalists that was with him performed.
Was it a girl?
Yeah.
Schaefer Lana.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And beautiful, if I'm not
voice.
Mistaken.
So talented.
Showstopper. And that was the last song. And I'm like, that's Jimbo Mathis right there. He didn't say he gave his last song up because he didn't have to give anything up to that kind of quality. But he helped bring that artist to light with the finest moment, the most important moment, the thing people are going to remember, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm like, that's classic.
Mm-hmm.
Jimbo, you know. But, I mean, I remember four songs before when I got my Jimbo, you know, right there. Then, you know, after the show, he came around and there's lots of funny things I'm not going to relate. But after the show, he came around, he was, you know, ready to sign or talk. And let me tell you what, no strangers there. Mm-hmm. Everyone that came by, and I stood in the back and let the first wave of people come through. And some of them got albums, some of them got merch. He was not selling anything, but he would certainly sell it to you. He was over there available, and mm-hmm. they signed it and everything. And they were complimentary. And finally, you know, I walked up there and he's like, hey, I was Daniel Sharp, you know. I was like, hey, you remember me? Well, of course I do, you know, and everything. And I hadn't anticipated, but, you know, we got a photograph together, and I'll send it over to, it's I love it. I love it. You know, we were both at the end of the show, and he's like, what did he say? The first time he says, you made it down here. I had not laid eyes on Jimbo since our recording session, because I went back and caught him at another show one time after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say another thing about Jimbo, since we're talking about him, I mean, we've kicked this thing off, and I didn't mean for this to be a whole thing about that. But after the first time I connected with Jimbo as a musician,
yeah,
there's this thing called the Mississippi Sound Co-op. And this gentleman named Reverend Robert Earl Reed,
oh yeah,
a legend,
yeah,
was doing this thing where he was bringing Delta and other musicians from around the state together and putting them at bars, and it would be like a variety show, one after another, bang, 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 bang. And this friend of mine, songwriter person that we discussed earlier, was living at this very cabin. Now I'm breaking the third wall, but this very cabin where we're doing this interview, and that friend of mine had got invited to be on the Sound Co-op.
Oh, wow.
And so I rode out and just came out. Of course, you know, I threw my guitar too.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, you know, Reverend Robert O. Reed was like, hey, somehow I got to play. You know, I'm sure it wasn't hard, you know. That was the first night I met Jim Ellis. And I played two or three songs. They videoed it. None of it came out. The video was not working, something. And after it was over with, we went to the green room next door, which then I later learned was Delta Recording Service. And the room was literally green, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. Your memory messes, because the point I'm fixing to make is, you know, how did Jimbo knew the song Red Light already? And maybe he'd heard me play it that night. Maybe somebody had, I have no clue. But he's like, let's play Red Light, man, on the couch, you know. And we grabbed guitars off the wall, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, and they were not tuned. They were not anything. But I'm like, okay, this is the measure of a musician. Now I'm going to tune this sucker up, and I'm playing with Jimbo. Now he's going to play this song with me. That's awesome.
Yeah, your song.
Yeah. And he tuned one up, I tuned one up, and we played it on the couch. And you can see there's a video of this. And it's still on the internet. Halfway through it, I look up and I saw Rev, who I later became real good friends with. And Rev was then filming it. in the green room, which I, and I used to be real, maybe I still am a little weird about getting recorded, and we'll talk about that. Maybe, I don't know. But you can see me in the video look at the realization of the moment when I'm being recorded and Jimbo's playing lead with me on that last song I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. I mean, for me, I'm great. I'm not saying that. But that video is still rolling around the internet in a couple of places on YouTube. And I think all you got to do is put my name and Jimbo's in and maybe Red Light and you got it.
It come up.
And it was the first night to jam. First time I jammed with him on that couch was probably a bus seat, I think. I don't know. And first time for a lot of things that night. And there's something nobody knows about Red Light is. You can go see. It's probably got 40 views or something. I don't know. Maybe it's got 100. I don't know. Oh, I know. I used to have MySpace, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
MySpace.
I had Red Light up on MySpace from this recording session David and I had done with Mississippi Chris Sharp at Timberview. That was like my greatest, well, not my greatest, it was what I was proud of, because my MySpace Red Light, on old school MySpace when it was cool. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know what it's like now, but old school MySpace.
Non-existent.
was cool, man. And I had over 10,000 listens on my Red Light on MySpace.
That's kind of huge for MySpace.
It was huge at that point. 10,000.
Yeah.
And I think you know.
I think 1,000 would have been.
That's
huge
how
on
I got
MySpace,
set up with Delta Recording Services. I went right to their MySpace and was like, you know. And Jimbo thought when we got there that, because we're from Philadelphia, he's like, I thought you were from Philadelphia. I was like, we are from Philadelphia. Mississippi. Mm. He's like, laughed. He goes, I thought you were talking about Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was like, well, it's cool, man. Let's do this. You know, and we locked the doors. I remember during our session, someone knocked on the door. And I was like, should I answer that? And I think Jimbo was a little conflicted at that point. It's one of the few times. And he thought, maybe we should. But we're working here. Maybe we shouldn't. He kind of left it up to me, I guess. I kind of remember walking over and kind of peeking out the window. And it was some ladies, I don't know, maybe around town. I don't know. Maybe they came by there sometimes to do something, to say hello. Maybe they had muffins or who knows. It was, who knows what it was. And that was enough. You know, they were not there. It was not anything necessarily important. I just kind of came back and I got my guitar again, you know, and we continued with the, and that was like 5 o'clock in the evening. And we, continued into the deep, deep hours of the night recording. And you want to talk?
No, I mean,
okay,
yeah, go ahead.
We recorded my favorite song that me and David ever recorded there. When I say my favorite, it was the most authentic thing we've ever won. Well, it's one of the most, and it's also one of my favorites because David and I wrote this particular song, which I won't play today, but maybe we'll link it or something. I don't think it, maybe I got it up hidden somewhere for the time being. I'm pretty weird about putting stuff up, and that's probably how I am. But it's called Freedom Fighters.
Yeah.
And it was just me and him Jimbo on that particular album that's never been released. Jimbo played lots of stuff during the thing, and so did Justin Shoa. And we had lots of cool things put into there. There's goat hooves on that album. Like, he's like, that needs some goat hooves. I'm like, well, goat hooves.
Yeah,
you want some goat hooves on that song? I was like, I definitely want goat hooves, you know.
Let's go out to a pasture, right?
No, he had them on a string. He had goat, he had dried goat hooves on a string that made a clicking noise when you put them together.
Oh, wow.
Literally, yeah. Crick. And that particular song is called Strong Swimmer. And it has goat hooves on it.
Is this album still around? Is it in the barn?
That particular one I'm talking about is in a computer around here, and we can queue it up and listen to it or burn a disc off of it or whatever.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it later.
Yeah,
but
heck, we'll I'll burn you one.
Awesome.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you about the whole every song in detail. No reason to go into that. I think I've covered all that for
us. Yeah, I like this, and we'll pick it right up. we're in this episode, and let me introduce it.
hey.
Welcome you to Porch Talk. This is your host, Alan. And to give you a little background on this episode, this pot got stirred well over a year ago when I met Philip Sable, and when Philip found what I was doing. And maybe you're a first-time listener, but Porch Talk does a lot of traveling and getting up with musicians who are pro musicians, like legit, and going to them to capture what they do. And when Philip and I, we're in a band together now, so I mean, you know how well it went for me and Philip, but he continually plugged a man named Daniel Sharp. And we would talk about like the Dartwater days and like, you know, the red light story, and talk about Dave. And so like, I'm someone who is well aware of Daniel just through story. And now it's good to pick his brain, because a lot of times someone who wants to write a song is left in the dark about the art of songwriting. And if you were to sit down and ask a songwriter how to write a song, well, every song is different, because every song is a story in a sense, and we're telling a story about what happened. But the beauty of it is you never went through what happened to me or what I observed, but you can relate to it and you can put your own story with that. And that is the beauty of a song. Like if I were to play Georgia or like one of my songs, it might hit you different than what I actually intended when I wrote it. And Daniel, I got a lot of respect for your songwriting. And on top of that, just like with the inside scoops of Red Light, I've never heard that. And I mean, it's coming from...
Oh, well, that's not
it's even... coming from you.
I wrote that song years before David and I even played together. And I've never really... Well, you're going to hear a lot of things that have never really been talked about, but let me tell you how and why I wrote this song.
Yeah.
Red Light. All right. The year was something.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a ASCAP competition coming up out at the casino. And I had no idea what all that meant. I just looked at it and said, okay, well, you're supposed to submit a song, you know, and I assumed they needed a radio song. All right. So I said, well, I'm going to write one of those.
It's crazy to put it that way, but it's so true.
Yeah. I assumed that's what they wanted.
Yeah. You know,
because I had all these other ones that are in detail. And later I was explained to by a very successful producer that some of my songs were self-serving. Not in a bad way. But so I needed this radio song. I'm like, okay. So I'm thinking about it, and I'm on the way to a gig with another friend of mine who's an amazing musician, and pulled up.
Was this Dave?
No. This is before Dave. It was actually Jonathan Parkinson.
Okay.
And he and I had this band called J.D. Irish. It was a duet, and we played a whole lot of traditional Irish and Scottish English ballads with some rock and roll and a few originals, and it was real weird. and he is amazing vocalist, guitarist, percussionist, you name itist, production guru. We didn't got enough time, you know. I don't want to bust off in 30 minutes about John. One of the most talented people in music that I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing a gig at a coffee house one time, and some dude walks in, you know, and I was the only one in there except for the owner. And he comes up after my song and he says, hey, I dig your stuff, whatever, you know, play two, whatever. I was like, no, I was like, you want to play one? Sure. Handed over the guitar, blew me away. I was like, oh, okay. Now I got
it's always how it starts.
Got to get out with this guy. Right. So we went along. We had our little band, Jonathan Daniel, J.D. Irish. And our first gig was at a Methodist church. And they put it on, and we both wished that we'd
is
take a picture.
Is this in Philly at this time?
No, it was near Philly. It was near Philly, but not in Philly. We were based out of Philly.
We mean Philadelphia, Mississippi,
Philadelphia,
by the
Mississippi.
Way.
And so they actually put our name up on the marquee as J.D. Irish. And we're like, that's so cool, you know. And I don't even remember exactly what we played at that church, But it was not anything out of order for a church, nor was it in order for a church. It was very something. It was no Irish music. We didn't play any Irish music that night. I think we played originals that were all sort of safe. Mm-hmm. We had plenty. And anyway, so we're sitting, he and I are going to do a gig.
Did you invoke the spirit of rock and roll?
Always. I mean, it's impossible not to. For, I guess. I mean,
I think so too, if you're being genuine.
We're sitting at a red light, and we're going to a gig. He didn't know where we're going. I said, take a ride at that red light. Take a ride at the red light. And we did. And I thought right then, I was like, I got my radio song. I just got to go
home. Take a ride at the red light.
So I went home, and I wrote it. Take a ride at the red light, baby. No, it don't matter if you don't think twice. And I actually went to Jonathan's studio at his home, in his room. And oh, yeah, and by the way, this is funny. The thing said, when you bring your song to the show, if you win, you will be asked to perform it then and there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, does that mean they'll have a PA? Should I bring my guitar? Should I? So what we did was we recorded it in his studio, which is, of course, is quite different than the later versions that David and I did. David put his own flavor on it. And then we did one with no vocals in case they asked me to use a CD once I won.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really, really banking on this. So I've got like a karaoke track of that with Jonathan playing electric, and he played drums, and he played bass, and I played this, and we did all that. And I also took my guitar just in case they needed that, because I'm ready to, you know, I'm ready to win. I go in there, the ASCAP thing, and it turns out it was also like they had a panel of some great songwriters. Mm-hmm. And while they were there, they were also asking you to sign up for ASCAP, which is a very credible thing to do for anybody in the industry, is to sign up for a licensing company. And there's a few. There's CSAC, there's BMI, there's ASCAP. I'm not endorsing any of them. Mm-hmm. Pick one. If you're going to do it, pick one. Do your thing, you know. But it was cool. They explained everything about ASCAP, and they talked about these famous songs they'd all written. And I remember one guy was there, and I think he had written a whole bunch of songs for maybe Michael Jackson or something. And I was like, in awe. And then they got around to Mac McAnally.
Oh, yeah.
Was on the panel.
Get out of here.
In a Hawaiian shirt. And when he came out, I said, well, that's worth it. I'll tell you what, now it's worth it. I don't know what's fixing to happen, but I was sitting in the front row. I was on the front row on the edge of my seat listening to Mac McAnally talk.
How old were you at this point?
I'm going to have to think about it in vehicles. That's how I gauge my age, but I was past 24 because I used to say I was 24 when I was roaming in Mexico, and it was after that. So I must have been, I was in my late 20s. I was in my late 20s.
Okay.
Could have even been 29.
All right.
That's the era. And Mac McAnally.
Yeah.
And so we go through the whole thing. I think it was a couple of days, and you might have had to come back 2 days. I don't remember. I just remember hearing these stories. And when it was over with, okay, I'll tell you who won the competition. So they're done. They've judged by now. Everybody's there's 100 people that had submitted. They're all there. You got to be present to win, you know. And they judged out the competition, announced the winners, played their songs, none of which were present to win. And it was clear, not taking anything away from these very popish songs that won it. There was three genres in three places. One of them was pure straight up radio country. Like, oh, there it is. That's pure.
That's the winner.
Yeah. Another one was straight up like a rap sort of thing. They're great now, good songs, whatever. Another one was something else, like straight up pop. Boom, boom, boom. Uh-huh. These are the winners. And none of them are present. And you should have seen all the guitars in the place. Everybody was ready to play that
one. So, I mean, just to stop right there, though, it's like you already knew what to do. You was like, let me do my best radio song. And like, so...
I was like, well, my radio song's better than any of them. I mean, I didn't. Of course, that's...
Well, I mean, I think any radio song...
But I think what happened...
I think any song off radio is better than what's
what might have happened. Yeah. I'm not sure what happened. What might have happened is most likely in that era, and I don't know how it is now, but they were pre-selected, these winners.
Yeah.
Because you have people that have been working with ASCAP for a long time, and they need something on their publicity to punch them up to the next level. And they're like, well, eventually we're going to let these people win a contest and that can promote them onto the deal because we have vested interest in this. And why would we give a winner? Why would we give a winnership to someone who's not even a member of ours? I'm just making this up. I can't tell you that's what happened, but that's certainly what it felt like when none of them were present to win, and nor were they prepared to play their songs. And I don't blame Mac McAnally for that one bit. I don't care. And he didn't have nothing to do with that. He just gave me the greatest stories of all time, you know?
Yeah.
He talked about Jimmy Buffett in first person. But after it was over with, you know, everybody disappeared except for Mac. All the other writers went away. That's fine. Mac walked right off the stage, walked right into the crowd, and he stood there and shook hands and talked to people for as long as they wanted. About anything they wanted to. And I saw person after person after person hand him a CD. Well, they all had one because they were ready for it, you know?
Yeah.
And like, here's my stuff, here's my stuff. And I was like, oh, they're trying to make it happen. Like, this is the cliche. If I could just get my disc to so-and-so. But before that, I was thinking like, man, I'll just give Mac McAnally my disc, you know? And I saw all these people hand him, and he was gracious. You could not have told he was not going to go listen to every word of every song, but I'll be willing to bet you he did. Because he had too many, and he had, you know, maybe he did. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. Maybe he listened just like
fishing
every... for,
it's just like fishing emails now, you know, like just even with the show. Like, and I'm not near his level, but I mean, CDs, since we started doing this and it kind of gained prominence, is like, you know, from emails to messages to mail, it's like I'm still going through music. So, I mean... I intend to. But I wonder what the intent of that is. It's like, dude, do you think I'm going to listen to, like, we're being gracious, we're going to hear you out, you're going to give me a CD, and, like, literally it's going to get lost in the glove box.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's just it. But you got to shoot your shot, right? Because you miss every shot you don't take.
That's right. I mean, and, you know, one in a million of those people got a song on the radio because they do that.
Probably so.
You're there. The CD's there. Why not give him one?
Yeah.
I probably should have gave him one. But if I had given him one, I would have felt like everybody else, and I like to not feel like everybody else. I didn't give him one. But, you know, I could have. He might have listened to it. He might have liked it. Who knows? But I didn't, and it wouldn't matter. I mean, you know, it wouldn't matter. Well, the thing is, even if you do like it, I mean, it's not like anything's going to happen. Mm. I've played my music to people that are professional, and they really liked it, and still nothing happened. You
know? Right.
It's like you... As an artist, the first thing you got to do is be a professional and have a product that is marketable and backed up by diligence and professionalism. And even then, even that's not enough. Here's a couple of questions you're going to be asked by a legitimate source. They're going to say, how many albums have you sold? What's your mailing list look like? Mm-hmm. So if you ain't sold no albums and you ain't got no mailing list, and all you got is the best music in the world, all you're doing is asking someone else to do that work for you when there's 1,000 people who have equally good music who have already done that work. So if you're going to be handing your CDs out, if you're going to be sending emails, if you're going to be going around trying to hit the magic number, you had better have already backed it up with work and effort and talent before you ever get there, because there are so many other people that have already done that. And it is just literally, if there's let's say it's a record label, they'd rather put less work in than more. If someone has a legitimate product, they've sold 10,000 records, they have 50,000 people on their mailing list. And I'm speaking in 20 years ago terms, because now there's like all the followers. I don't understand that. I got the concept, but I don't, you know, there are already people that are known quantities who have an instant place for people to buy their work. So if I'm a record label and you come to me and you've sold 10,000 CDs and have 50,000 followers and you're great, versus someone that shows up who just walked out of their house and happened to also be great, but has done none of the work and it like looks at me and says,
just claiming to be,
and says, even if they are that good. And they're looking at me and saying, here's my great work. Now go out and sell me some albums and build me a following, because I'm an artist and all I want to do is write. And you, as a record label, you might go, well, the guy before you is equally as good.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying they're better. I mean, everybody's good in their own way. But they already did this work, and we're gonna make some profit off of them next month.
Yeah.
It's gonna take 2 years to get you where they're at, and so a label or a producer has really got to believe, really super got to believe in you as a raw, nothing. You know, these are my opinions.
But no, I mean, I think I'm with that. It's like, I think about like. With the nature of music where we are now, it's like you have a lot of indie labels and then you still have your mass, you know, corporate record labels that gallop up those indie labels. But the beautiful thing about, let's just take Fat Possum or Dialback, Cornelius Chapel in Birmingham, is they really have a pulse on what good is in that area, or however they find it. Single Lock, they did that Cedric Burnside, I Be Trying, phenomenal record. That recorded up in Muscle Shoals, you know, Cedric's here, he lives here in Mississippi. And they still have their finger on the pulse of this community and what this music and what this is about. But when it gets to a corporate, to where you remove that pulse, and like a lot, and I don't blame them for doing it. I'm not shitting on anybody for doing this. Yeah. It's like,
hey, I'm not either.
You know, make a little money, sell out your company, and like let it be commercial. Yeah, go for it, dude, if that's what you can do. But I was like, we're going to keep finding diamonds, and they'll never get to the surface because we didn't get through the coal. And the coal will be the only thing that gets there.
That's right. And but behind you over there, there's a piece of cardboard and it says Lost or Never Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip, who we discussed earlier, and myself set this cabin up as a studio for a little while. And I coined that phrase Lost or Never. And the reason being what we're discussing now, that there are so many things out there, artists that are great, whose work will be either lost to time. And I've seen it happen. I've seen my work be lost to time, but the lost to me. I've seen my own work be lost to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Or either, even worse, it will never see the light of day. So
it's the whole never.
Point of putting the cardboard sign up over my door that said Lost or Never Records was to be a capture place for artists who couldn't find big time with a roadmap. Didn't care about it. Didn't never want it. I've been associated with so many of them, and they frustrate me. And maybe I'm frustrating too. But lost or never. Like let's get it mm-hmm. before it's lost, or even worse, before it is never. You know. So that sort of worked its way back around the all the way around to that.
Well, let's back it up to like just introduction is Daniel like of. Where was you raised? Right here?
Yeah, in part. I mean, I was born here in Philadelphia, Mississippi. My youth, I traveled around with my parents. My dad was a union sheet metal worker, so that took him to other states.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember lots of elementary schools and other places, Goose Creek, South Carolina, Washington, Indiana, a few times. Somewhere in Ohio, I can't remember the name. Lots of places on the road. And then I would come back here for a year of school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go back out there for a year of school. And so I got a really unique perspective and upbringing with different cultures and different people and how things were being new, being the new person. And maybe I developed some mechanism for.
Yeah, because I didn't want to base like asking that question on like just music or you traveling, but I mean you did a pretty good job of opening the door. Is like because you've done quite a bit of traveling for one, and musically involved, and we'll get into some more of what you're involved in.
Yeah, and then say when I was got to around in my teens, like I landed here, mm-hmm. And got involved in the organized band at school. I was a percussionist. I later was the drum captain. I later was the band captain. I went to college on a percussion scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Won the John Philip Sousa one time. So I was really into that, and that was, a real crucible. I might use that word again. and had this epic band director who was like totally militaristic, and he's in one of my songs called Double Edge of a Sin. Yeah, and I think it could be on the Jimbo record, maybe. I know the song is. I don't know if I called out that band director, but he was a taskmaster. I mean, and I got a lot of my work ethic from that. Now, but as musically speaking, though, I was a musician long before I joined organized band.
How'd that start for you?
My mother is a...
Records? Or?
She's a phenomenal musician.
Oh.
She plays keys. She plays piano. And in her youth, she...
Classically trained?
No. As a matter of fact, is the opposite of that. Like, she just plays by ear. And when she was a kid, they bought her a piano, and she carved her name into it. It's still up there at the old house. And she played at church.
Of course.
And one time, the preacher came around and said, Patty, please don't put the boogie to it today. And she said, I told him, she says, but they give more money when I put the boogie to it. She was a kid still, and I already figured that out. And so they gave her piano. She has natural talent.
Mm-hmm.
I'd liken her sound to Jerry Lee Lewis.
Wow.
And so she played. She took some lessons for a few months, and they had a recital, and at the church. I think it was at, maybe it was at the community hall, and everybody came. My grandparents came, and she says that the piano teacher didn't like her because she was unstructured and out of the box, and she couldn't get her to do what she wanted her to do. Mm. So she gave her this funeral dirge to play. Bum, 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 bum. And it went on like that. And she'll play it to this day. Bum, 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 bum. And then she's supposed to, at the end of this, bum, 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 bum. It's real simple. She's supposed to get up, take a bow, walk off.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, she might even say, the devil made me do it. She says, but, couldn't stand it. At the end of that dirge, she walked it up to bum 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 bum, and it hit the boogie, and the whole place came alive. And when she got off, the piano instructor was on one side of the stage just waiting to just bless her out, you know. And she said she took that bow and she walked off the other side of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the piano instructor came to my grandparents and said, I will not teach her anymore. She cannot do this. She is not going to be a piano player. And then she of course was.
Yeah.
And so my whole youth.
She's so punk rock.
Yeah, she was punk rock before it was even known what that was. And so my whole youth was spent, she had me singing. We'd spend these long, long drives from here to wherever we was going to work. And I was so little, I would stand up on the truck seat in the middle. There was no seatbelt stuff going on.
Your parents then. Always commuters?
No, when I say we were driving there to our new home.
Oh, okay, I see.
In our home or our apartment. Mm-hmm. In these, and we would drive back to Mississippi, and we would drive back on these trips.
Mm-hmm.
And I would stand on the seat, and my head would not touch the top of the cab. And I would stand between my parents, and I would sing either with the radio, or I would sing without the radio with all these songs that she'd taught me. Mm-hmm. We're talking like Don Williams and Marty Robbins. Mm-hmm. These are the, and I did have a record player, and I had these records, and I burnt those records up, and I knew every word. And later, when I was old enough to buy my own records, I was still in the record era. There were no cassette tapes at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the cusp of that. When I got into my 11, 12, 13, whatever, we got tapes, you know, and I still love records. But, yeah, I'd stand on the truck seat and I would sing these, and she tells a funny story that she says, we're driving one time, and she says, I looked right at her and says, because she'd always tell me, you know, when I die, I want you to sing at my funeral. And this is to a child. I didn't know what that meant. I looked at her one time, she says, and she does it, and like this, I had this southern drawl. She says, Mom. She says, yeah. I said, figured out what I'm going to sing at your funeral. She says, what is it? And I broke loose on this song, Daddy Was a Preacher and Mama Was a Go-Go Girl. And that was funny. And I remember singing the song Eastbound and Down, Loaded Up and Trucking. It was one of my favorites because I'd seen that movie, you know.
Yeah.
And she played, one time she was playing in a bar up on a hill, and Loretta Lynn came in.
No way.
and she got to play with Loretta Lynn at this honky-tonk one time. And she tells a great story.
What part of the world?
Like, we, I was in Meridian, Mississippi. She, Loretta wasn't there to play. She was Loretta there. Was there after one of her shows.
Yeah.
And that's cool. And so that's where the hook got in me. And I remember I went to kindergarten for the first year, and we had to paint a picture of what we wanted to be in our career. Mm. And I painted a picture of a musician singing, you know. That's what I was going to be. Mm-hmm. No doubt in my mind. That was it. That was it for me. I never considered anything else. So much later, you know, I had some considerations when I grew up in the world a little bit. But I never actually did anything to the best of my that suited me so much. It seems like every time when I lived in Oxford, you know, I went to school. I went to Ole Miss for a while. I didn't get a degree there, unfortunately. But I'll tell you what, I played in a lot of bars. You know, I had a great time. I met many great musicians and had some great times. And like when I went to community college, the first thing I did after high school, and I went to community college on a full scholarship with music and this and that and the other, and I had a little small ACT scholarship and this. And I remember, like, I found out there were these bars way out in the middle of the woods where college kids went, and they had to be 21. And now none of those bars are open anymore, so don't go looking for them.
Yeah, don't go trying.
Yeah, they ain't out there. If they are, I don't know about them. But these particular ones are long. They're either closed or they're raised to the ground. But I found a few of them. I mean, I found them right away. And I remember walking right up to the owners and saying, I'm a musician and I got a band. I didn't have a band, but I said, I got a band and we want to play here and we want to play on Wednesday night. And then okay, you got it. You know, well, you can work for the door.
Mm-hmm.
It was, $5 or $10 a head. Okay, we'll do that. Then I went and I had some, I've skipped a band or two in my story, but I had a little OPA system and some junk. And so I got it together and then I went around and I got some musicians and, I remember one of them only played electric, and I'm like, man, I've got acoustic. You've got to have an acoustic electric. And I thought you must have one. He went out and bought him one, which he never played once at the show. He was so good on electric, he could play it behind his head. And we got a drummer, and we got a bunch of vocalists, and we just went in there and jammed it out. And I got a guy to work the door for us. It was a friend of ours, and paid him $20 for standing up there all night long. And the first night, I made $1,000. I equally split it up with the whole band. I thought to myself, this is great. You can just go to a bar and make a grand anytime you want.
Mm.
Well, little did I know, that is actually not the truth. You may not just go to a bar in the middle of nowhere and make $1,000 anytime you want. But in those days, since it was a college bar in the middle of nowhere, you could make $1,000. And we did that a long time. And I believe that we jokingly called our band the Cat Daddies with a K. And I don't even know what that meant. Still don't know why we did. Yeah. And there was a bunch of stupid, funny names. But that was a block building, that particular one. But we played several of those little places and we made tons of money to the point that anybody that was a musician tried to get up and wanted to play with us so they could get their $200, you know, for some poor college kid. And we'd deal it out. We'd dish it out to them. If you got up and played a few songs, we had a few people just sing two or three songs. They got $200 too, you know.
That's good. I believe in that. Open mics and open jam nights. And I want to plug, I think there's a great thing going on in Jackson, Mississippi. I think it happens on Wednesday night. It's not just an open mic, it's an open jam.
Hmm.
And they'll have the seasoned musicians of Jackson playing. And if maybe you're new to the city, or maybe, you know, you're a learning musician, here's your opportunity to step up on the stage with the pro.
Right on.
And here's your opportunity to learn. And, like, you have to cut your teeth. And I remember being, like, teenager and young 20s, and, you know, I knew everything. There was nothing you could tell me. And then when you get out there in the world, I mean, this is so different. It's like, as far as, like, how music works. And even now, just by doing the show, it's like I've learned a lot about how music works. And it varies from town to town, to state, and what works, what doesn't work, and how you do it and how you sell. And I believe those are important for musicians, but like there's a certain sense of narcissism, and there's a certain sense of arrogance that will always come with the territory, and you have to flirt with it. But you know, it's, I hope it doesn't take you over, because take all you can from these moments in your youth when you're coming up to be like what you drew in kindergarten, was a working musician, is we have to learn, man. I mean, like, that's a hell of a story on cutting teeth, you know?
Oh, one of the first concerts I went to was Kenny Rogers. When I was
what better?
I was in first grade, and this was in Macon, Georgia, and Kenny Rogers came around. My mother took me to see Kenny Rogers, and he killed it. He killed it. I remember I was on edge. I was like, that was it. I wanted to be, you know. And then I heard him on the radio. I was like, Kenny Rogers, he is the man.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that was good. And you know, saw so many people at the fair, which I'm now talking about the Neshoba County Fair. We
recently experienced it.
Right.
I got That's one right. day out of 2 weeks, and this time next year, I plan to be there for the whole thing, because that shit was a blast. News and notes. If you haven't done so already, I would ask that you would rate and review the show on whatever podcast app it is that you listen to on. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Look for the logo. Look up Porch Talk 101. You'll find it. It's part 104. Here comes part two.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.